And we're going to take testimony on Senate Bill 23 and Senate Bill 1247. So we'll open the public hearing and work session to do that. I met the two gentlemen that are here, and I don't know if there's a sign-up sheet or not. Is there one there, Ingrid? Okay, well, if you could come forward and introduce yourself. Yeah. We met in the hallway, and I didn't grab your cards, so.
Which one you could do?
We're going to do 23 and 1247 with this one witness, and then we'll go back into public hearing on 944. And if you recall, when we heard this last Wednesday or Thursday, I mentioned there was one witness that wasn't available who was out of state, and this is our mystery witness. Good afternoon.
I apologize for not being here last week, but we were caught off guard by fast action, and I commend the committee for putting this together and taking a big step forward to doing privatization. As you're aware, we came out last summer and testified about privatization. And essentially what we talk about is privatization and some of the things that I saw in the bill that's been proposed that I think is good, and some things that to protect not only the state but the private company and not only the citizens of the state, but something that you should be aware of. Senate Bill 1247 I've had an opportunity to review, and probably the biggest thing that I would say is that some of the performance guidelines and some of the financial costs are spelled out all through the bill, and I would think that the state would probably want to spell out what exactly is required of the private vendor a little more specific, and in fact the private vendor would want you to spell it out. For example, it talks about qualifications of the private company in Section 2. You would want to, as a committee or as the Privatization Commission, want to set what you think is the minimum requirements for the history of that company. The company be in existence for so many years, operate so many facilities, be able to demonstrate that, in fact, they do hold median custody inmates. And so that language throughout the bill, I would think you want to spell out pretty specific, or at least give the authority to the commission that is created from this bill to, in fact, talk about that. Same thing with insurance. You talk about insurance requirements. What exactly, what insurance requirements do you want? How much policy, how much liability? And those are some of the things that I would encourage you to do in the commission. The second thing I would also suggest is that it's referenced throughout the bill about American Correctional Association standards. I would recommend you go a step further and require that facility be accredited by the American Correctional Association. Not only the fact that the standards are being followed, but in fact an outside agency is coming in and putting a stamp on of approval that in fact they are in compliance with the standards that are set by ACA. ACA are the only national standards that are set nationwide by correctional people. They're set by people in the Department of Corrections, jail administrators, sheriffs across the country. I don't think I have to give you much history about ACA because most of you, I think, are pretty familiar. I worked there for about 9 years before I went to work for Corrections Corporation of America. But the thing that I would really strongly recommend that in fact you do that. And you will find, if you've done research on privatization across the country with this, that in fact it's required by the Department of Corrections or the state that private companies be accredited. So you will find those companies are accredited on a far more national average than public agencies are.
The accreditation then applies both to public and private correction facilities?
Correct.
And how many states take part in that? Is it uniform? Do all 50 states?
No. I've left that 4 years ago, but the numbers I recall, there's probably, if you were to include the 3,500 jails, halfway houses, juvenile facilities, 10,000 correctional facilities in the country, just a little over 1,000 of them are involved in the accreditation process. And there are some states that are fully accredited, for example, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Florida, Louisiana, New Mexico. Those are states that have used that as a vehicle to release them from consent decrees and court orders in their states. For example, Louisiana is the best example. They have been under consent decree for 20 years fighting the consent decree and the court order. They're finally about out from underneath of it. There's still some issues they have to work out. But the whole state is fully accredited state facilities, and the Secretary of Public Safety has also required all public facilities that contract with the Department of Louisiana be accredited too. So essentially what he's saying is both sides of the fence are doing everything according to the ACA standards. So in the case of the adult facility or the juvenile facility, I would require both of them to be accredited by ACA. And that's something...
Is Oregon accredited?
As far as I know, they're not right now. Like I say, I've been away from it 4 years, so...
Now...
That's not to say that the department is not following the standards. They're not the accreditation process. They were us.
And is that in part because there's a fee to go that you have to pay in order for the work to be done to see if you're accredited?
Why they're not involved, I couldn't answer, sir.
But is there a fee?
There is a fee, yes. And that's about $10,000 for every 3 years. And it's something that... Per facility, yes. But that's the administrative fee paid to ACA. It's a commitment by the staff to have somebody on staff full-time to monitor that compliance. So there's other expenses and costs of that.
Can I take you back a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
You're with Correction
Corporation. Correction Corporation, Kevin Ashburn. Uh-huh.
Can you fill us in a little about...
CCA?
CCA.
Okay.
How large it is, when it was formed, how many facilities,
okay,
et cetera, et cetera.
We, Corrections Corporation of America, has been around since 1983. We were founded back prior to 1983 by two gentlemen who were both graduates of West Point, who were roommates at West Point. One was appointed by the governor of the state of Tennessee at the time to look at overcrowding and find a way and a solution to overcrowding. These two gentlemen, being old West Point graduates, were together one time, and they said, you know, what can we do about the problem that Tennessee is having with overcrowding and with consent decrees and court orders? That's when the privatization thing really started as far as what we know privatization. Now, there's been privatization been around for many years. There's been halfway houses run by various nonprofit and profit organizations. But as far as really the privatization, the way we know it now, median custody inmates was started in 83. The one thing that the two co-founders knew and realized that the only way they were going to make this program work was to, in fact, bring in somebody from the outside in corrections to build in quality assurance. And that's what they did. They brought a retired director that ran the Arkansas and the Virginia and started his career in Texas. And that's where privatization started. Right now we have 75 facilities, 62,000 inmates under contract. We're scattered throughout the country in about 27 states. We also hold inmates from various states to include Alaska and Hawaii and Wisconsin. We have some states that do not have privatization facilities in their states, but they send their inmates out of state. So,
how many states are you involved in?
About 27.
And any West Coast states?
California, we have 3 facilities. Idaho, we're building a new one right now. Montana, we're building a new one as well. And we have one in Arizona, 2 in Arizona in operation, and 1 under construction in Arizona.
I didn't mean to interrupt testimony, but I wanted to see filled in a little more on your background. And
okay,
your current position with...
Director of Business Development.
Director of Business Development.
Yes. I apologize. I know you're in a rush to get the schedule on an evening session, so I'm trying to help along. The one thing that we have found, that accreditation is something that we can use, getting back to the accreditation issue, something that we can in fact say, yes, we follow accreditation, we follow the standards, we build the standards, and that in fact you all, the customer, as well as the public, is getting the bang for their dollars. And in fact, we're doing things the way they're supposed to be done. And so I strongly encourage that to be required or spelled out or tinkered in the legislation to require those facilities to do that. I'd also then would, in fact, with the ACA accreditation, that will address several other issues, especially in Section 7 of the bill, which talks about training and the department overseeing and ensuring that the training is, the standards are set by ACA. They meet the ACA standards, so in fact, the standards deal with everything from administration, management, budget, physical plant, training, security, medical, health care, programs. That's all spelled out. And that, in fact, would spell out in the bill and take away some of that questionable things. What is questionable?
kind of keep them.
Chair, the, Diane Niddle from the BC DST.
Right.
That we have stated in this bill would look at the program for training, was concerned about the cost to them to look at training and everything. So are you saying that the ACA does have standards and those for training?
Yes, ma'am.
Specific and a curriculum?
Yes, there are specific topics that are covered. Yes, they have to be covered at a minimum. Yes.
Okay. So that might help to eliminate the problem that she would foresee with sort of gearing up to be looking at other things. And if I could also ask, you mentioned at the beginning of your testimony the fact that we should require a certain amount of experience from a company and state the amount of liability insurance that we required. And on page 2, line 1, well, first of all, on page 120, line 23, it does say that, you know, that we're going to look at the company, and they have to have experience in management personnel. And then on page 2, line 1, it's also stating that the provider's preceding 5 years, you know, there's things alluding to 5 years, which gives you kind of a length of time of experience.
Right.
You don't think that's sufficient?
That should be sufficient, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
The more you spell it out, Senator, the less, the more you take away
ambiguity.
And the more credible what you're coming to the table from the companies you're going to do. You're going to bring in experienced people, people that, and I hate to say will be eliminated because they don't qualify, but you're going to bring in people that are experienced at this and that you feel comfortable with their track record, with their insurance policy, and with their experience.
And I was thinking, Mr. Chair, that some of this would be done in that commission, in the contract specifically, so that we didn't have to spell everything out in the in the bill, but you know what, I would certainly
in the contract. Section 8, the private provider may not determine the type of work that inmates perform or the amount of compensation to be paid for the work. I would think that whatever facility would be authorized by the commission, say a 500-bed medium security facility to hold 25 to 35 or whatever the department's criteria is, that in fact they would have to abide by whatever inmate wage program and inmate job classification there are with the department. So that's just something that it's not odd to say that we, you know, that we would not be setting the compensation, but in fact would be comparable to whatever the Department of Corrections pays for their jobs and whatever jobs they may be. This way it would take away the possibility of the state paying more or less to an inmate as opposed to us or a private vendor. So that's something that I thought, it's not a big deal, but it could be a management operational issue. Section 9, it talks about, obviously, the services provided by the contract and shall reimburse the commission. Any time where you can spell out the cost to the state or the cost to the private vendor, you'll feel better, and I feel better, and the state will feel better trying to make the analysis of the state facility operating at one fee, the private facility operating at another fee, and meeting the 7% that you're requiring them to savings. So wherever your cost can be spelled out for you, the state as well as us, I would strongly recommend that. And it just probably would take some people to sit down and tinker those little verbs and vowels out. I don't think it's a big deal, but just something that to be spell out in the RFP when they issue it, and then of course would spell out in the contract too. But when you're doing something that you're not only talking about putting a facility out for privatization, but you're also talking about a cost comparison between the state and that, and you're taking in all consideration of cost for the state versus the private sector person. So wherever those costs can be spelled out, that'll make the analysis a lot easier.
Sure.
Yes, sir.
In terms of cost, and maybe you're not the appropriate person to ask this question, but
As I read this, all it requires a private provider to do is run it, the facility in a more cost-effective and secure manner. I'm just curious whether providers are required to provide education and treatment for drug and alcohol and treatment for sex offenders.
I would assume that that would be in the contract that we write with the provider. And that's what the commission would determine.
But one thing, and you don't have the advantage of what was said at the last hearing, unless someone reads you, was there was a discussion that, of course, costs are always a factor, but we're less concerned about saving money, or at least I was, and more interested in outcomes, you know, how good a job you do, do your prisoners return at a higher rate, have tendency to have more crimes, more victims than the public side, you know, and we know that adult education, alcohol, drug treatment, cognitive skills, work skills, all those things are important elements that need to take place inside the institution, and otherwise they're just going to reteach. And I don't know if you have any facilities now that are reviewed on an outcomes basis. If I think it's a relatively new field for corrections to go down that path.
There are several studies that have been done, and I'll leave with your clerk a comprehensive book that was put together by Adrian Moore that talks about some of those issues. There are some studies that have been done. Part of the problem with studies is some people will say that works. Some say, no, that doesn't work. They don't like the way it was put together. And we can sit here and debate. And I'm certainly not. I come from corrections. I'm not a marketing person. I'm certainly not an accountant. I'm certainly not some kind of social scientist. But from a standpoint of corrections, yes, it does work. But there again, the system, what I feel and what I think most people will tell you, that in fact, if the system is in place, you're going to get some inmates to partake in that program, and you're going to get some that flat out don't want to partake. Part of the secondary release, as I say, part of their program or their rehabilitation is when they go back out on the street. And depending on how the department does it, whether he goes from a medium custody status to a minimum custody, work release, workhouse type, back out on the street, he's phased in, that's something that the state obviously has to set its own, where the department wants to go with that. But yes, we encourage them to be a part of that program, and we have done, we're very proud of a program called what we call Lifeline, which is a therapeutic drug treatment program we have in the facility. It's voluntary. It can go anywhere from 6 months to 18 months, again, depending on the status of the inmate, if he's going to be there for 18 months. It's very therapeutic. We, in fact, encourage that. As far as follow-up to that, no. There's not been a lot of studies from our standpoint other than the facility in Metro where our recidivism rate is pretty high. It's as far as returning, it's very low. It's very good success. But there again, that's one program in the Metro Nashville area, which is a county jail where people are going in and out. It's a little different than the state inmates that are released, and only parole and probation follow that up. There's also been a study done by the state of Florida that says that inmates in our facility down in Panama City, Florida, have a lesser return than state inmates. And again, we have a therapeutic community. We are very much work intensified. Unlike what the state does, there are more maximum security and work details and things like that. We work with inside the facility, a lot of education, a lot of programs. So there, I think, would be spelled out in your RFP or in your contract, I would think, that she'd want to
have any contracts that have specific miserable performance criteria that you're to meet?
As far as inmate performance, you mean inmate? None that I can recall of right off. No. Some do require education that so many inmates will graduate from GED, but as far as success rate as far as recidivism, though. And there may be some standards set that the parole board may, for example, I take that back, some require the parole board, for example, you mentioned sex offender cinema, that they go through a treatment program as a sex offender. So, yes, that's required, and the criteria is set by the state, but as far as a follow-up to where they go after their release from our facility, though, but we require that they go through programs.
I think the one state that did a recidivism study was Florida. They're about the only one, and I think because that commission exists, the information can go through them, otherwise it's private information. But the other thing I wanted to mention is we have included here the possibility of counties using this. And so for us to require counties to do some things, I mean, that may be one of the reasons why we didn't delineate every single thing that we want. And really felt that it's best left to the contract, the specific contract on the kinds of things that we would want.
Well, the reason I mentioned the criteria, measurable criteria, is, and I'm not an authority in this, but it's something that they're heading into, but no one's done that yet. And, of course, it requires a longitudinal study afterwards and some follow-up other than just whether or not someone has committed another crime and he's been convicted. Senator Brown.
Just a question. Is youth correction facility defined anywhere?
Are you looking at 23?
Yeah. Isn't that what we were on?
We're on both.
Okay. Good.
I'm more designed at 1247, but the same question I have for 23 as well, and that's something I'll address when I get to that.
The reason why I ask that is because as I read this, the department's already doing this. I mean, Out Front House is a, what I would presume, a youth correction facility located in Southeast Portland, and it's being run by a private provider. It's already happening the way it's written.
This isn't my desk.
Okay. I'm asking Bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is not my bill either, but
okay.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, it defines youth correction services, meaning services that are necessary for design, construction, finance, and maintenance, management, and operation of a youth correction facility. It does not define facility, but I assume that it means generic, broad-based definition.
Okay.
So you give the flexibility to have private operators, which they already do, both all over the system.
Okay. Thanks.
I think we mentioned last time here that some states in their boot camp type operations have private operators.
Okay. I looking the rest of the bill over from section 12 on, there was nothing that I saw that stood out. I thought it was pretty well defined in what's spelled out. A lot of reference to Oregon state statute, but there again, people can go back to the state statute, look up 42.1 and C79 and some of the other ones. So I didn't see anything else that stood out as being something that just kind of give you a little hint about looking into or expanding upon. In reference to the juvenile bill, I think that's pretty straightforward. I think the confusion that I had, and I probably apologize for my ignorance on Oregon or the state juvenile crime bill or what it stands at, but in some states, the Youthful Offender Act, whether that be a juvenile under the age of 18 who is tried and sentenced as a juvenile, or is there a youthful offender, which is somebody who falls into that category somewhere between juvenile and adult status. And you will find those in Florida, what they call youthful offender facilities. And those are typically kids that graduate from the juvenile system that still have time to do, but can't be held in a juvenile facility because they exceed the age of 18. So they're thrown into an adult system, but yet they're not thrown into it as here you are. Now you're with the big boys. You're in a youthful offender facility. So it's a transition from that juvenile to that adult. So you'll find those youthful offender facilities very common in Florida, and you're seeing that more and more. Arkansas has had several changes, obviously, in response to Jonesboro last year with their juvenile law, and that's something they've got to create as a youthful offender facility, somewhere where children can be go from age 18 into age 21 as a transition. So I wasn't sure whether the youthful offender, what that was all about in that part, and I'm sure that it's my own ignorance in not looking up the state statute when it comes to juveniles. But overall, I think that the bill is well written. I know you put a lot of thought into it. I know that you've obviously spent a lot of time researching. I was here last July, I guess it was June or July, and testified about privatization. And I'm glad to respond to any questions, specific questions that you may have.
Are there questions or comments? if you could reduce your comments in writing, especially as you talked about the specifics of what changes you thought to be needed,
I will do that.
That will be of significance to
us. Okay.
And you probably need to do that relatively soon.
Like on the way back tonight or on the way back tomorrow morning, yes. We apologize for the lateness.
And you're from Nashville?
Nashville, Tennessee, yes.
And CCA did make comments on this originally. Are your comments different today than the...
Essentially the same, yes.
Sure. Yes, the same. On the accreditation, we were talking about $10,000 per institution. It had to be a statewide or just individual institution, or would the whole state have to...
That's an individual price, and that accreditation lasts for 3 years.
3 years. Would that, if one does it, the whole group has to do it?
No. If the state of Oregon, for example, decided they wanted to credit all their new facilities, and again, it's physical plant too, and maybe the department says, you know, we've got some physical plant things that we can't change, we can't do, it's going to cost us more money, we choose not to do. I can't speak for the department why they don't do it, but we build, that's why the private company is going to build for the ACA standards and run it and operate it by ACA standards.
Two frivolous questions.
I know.
Well, where did you finally cite the prison in Montana?
In Helena, outside of Helena.
Helena.
I'm from down south, so I can't say those words.
I just live in a small city.
Town right outside of town.
Second, do you advertise Yellow Pages, anything like that, for prison sighting?
Is it part of their services offer prison sighting?
Absolutely.
I mean, in Yellow Pages, do you advertise Yellow Pages?
I'm
just going by the Yellow Page test, you know.
I think in corrections, Yellow Pages, yes.
In Nashville, Tennessee, you're probably listening.
We're in Nashville. Yeah. If you go to any correctional conference, American Correctional Association or other associations, we're there. The people in our business know us and we know them. So, in fact, yeah. But as far as specifically looking for some town to call me and say, I need to build a prison in this town, then we probably don't do that. But if, in fact, there's a need to site a prison and there's a RFP put out, you would have private vendors coming out looking for land purchase in phase one and go through all the, you know, just like the state of Oregon would, too, you know, if you want to put it in one county or one another county. So we would do the same thing the state would do when it's siting. And we would follow, in fact, the same standards that the department sets when we do site a prison. So.
Okay, thank you.
And you sometimes provide the funding for the construction, too, is that correct?
Yes. And that would be something you would want to spell out in your RFP, is in fact that the private company funds it, builds it, operates it, and you know, the RFP process and according to state statute, yes.
And then if there's a dispute later on and the state says you've reached the contract and the state kicks you out, they've got to probably buy the facility.
Yes.
They've got 1,500...
They've got
tenants there they need to keep inside.
Right.
Yes.
Probably get another private provider to run it.
Yeah. More than likely, that's
what
will happen. Yeah.
Has happened in other
private companies will sell out to other private companies because they choose to give up that contract.
Have you ever gotten a conflict with the state and ended up terminating your contract?
One in South Carolina several years ago, a juvenile system that was in a mess and we've helped them out. I can't think of any other ones other than the term of the contract. Most of ours are renewable. I'm trying to think of right off the top of my head. No. We do hold some inmates out of state temporarily, and when the new facility is built back in their home state, then those inmates are transferred back, so that contract is essentially closed in. But most of the private providers and vendors that do this will look at this very, very like a business person. They're going to see and say, yes, can we do this? They're going to look at all the costs. They're going to look at all the things they can do, and they're not going to stick their neck out, you might say, until they know they can do that process and do it right. So, because, in fact, that's how you stay in business is to do to make the customer happy. So you'll find that most of them don't want to take on something they can't.
Youngstown, Ohio, I think that was mentioned by one of the witnesses who opposes the idea. Is that one of your...
Yes, one of our facilities.
And I don't recall exactly what she said, but she indicated in her literature that there had been a problem there. Is that correct?
That's correct. We opened a facility in Youngstown about, I'm going to say, 2 or 3 years ago. Youngstown came to us and said, we need an economic development plan. We built a facility there in response to inmates, as if any of you are familiar with what's going on in D.C., the city government right now. Congress has forced the district to close down their D.C. correctional facilities in the District of Columbia, which are really located in Northern Virginia. They were overcrowded under court order, under consent decree. The courts were banging away. So we agreed to take inmates from the District of Columbia, took those inmates in, and ended up those 250 out of about 1,000 inmates were classified as maximum security inmates. And yes, we did have problems. There's no denying it. You can pick up the internet, you can pick up a newspaper. There were two killings there. There was also some escapes back in June or July of last year. All those people have been recaptured. Yes, those things are going to happen in the private sector. I hate to say it. It's not something I'm proud to talk about, but it's something that's real. And the fact, too, it happens in state facilities. I came from government. We had escapes. We had killings. We had assaults. And that's one of the criticisms of privatization is, in fact, can you trust the private company to, in fact, run Youngstown or any other facility with your 500, 1,000, 1,250 inmates? Since that time, we have come to an agreement with the District of Columbia and the Bureau of Prisons and the city, because all these parties are involved in this facility. In fact, enhanced security even more, tightened up the facility, and has been no problem since that time. They will be up for accreditation in August at the ACA Summer Conference. And that's just the turnaround that we made in that facility. And I think if you look at the history of facilities across the country, there are some stories that have happened, and we were able to respond to it and turn it around and make it happen. And I put that facility up against any facility. So, yes, we did have problems a year ago, Senator.
You talked about ACA accreditation. In the states where you are ACA accredited, are the public prisons in that state also ACA accredited?
Yes and no. For example, in Louisiana, we were the first one in the state to be accredited. Since that time, the whole state has been accredited. We are accredited in Texas. Texas is just starting in the accreditation process, so it just varies. Florida, they have been in the accreditation process for years, and so we're accredited. So in some states, yes, and some states, no.
Bill reminded me that we talked about this, and one of the reasons we didn't require the accreditation of the private company is because we weren't requiring it of the public, and we're gonna try to compare them. So, might be something to think about.
Yeah. Time, Georgia Department of Corrections, for example, was involved in the accreditation process. I can't speak for them now. I don't think they are, but they're required, our two facilities in Georgia, to be accredited by ACA. So it varies from state to state.
Thank you.
Okay. Good question. Well, thanks for coming out.
Thank you for having me.
We'll close then the public hearing on Senate Bill 1247 and 23 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 944 and invite Gina McLeod, Loretta Harwood, Phyllis Barker, and Dale Penn. I'm not sure which of you would like to go first, but it'd be helpful probably to have someone talk in generalities about the bill. So you're nodding?
I'm going to do that.
You're going to do that. Good.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee. My name is Gina McLeod. I'm the staff attorney for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 944. Senate Bill 944 addresses several significant changes that desperately need to be made in the sex offense statute. The first thing that it does is it omits the earnest resistance requirement in the definition of forcible compulsion that is used in rape in the first degree crime. You'll hear further testimony about how dangerous requiring a victim to earnestly resist for a rapist is. And you also hear more about requirement, how this requirement actually hinders investigation and prosecution of sex crimes. There's only 5 states that still have this archaic requirement on the laws. Oregon's sex crimes laws were originally modeled after Michigan, and Michigan has long since omitted earnest resistance as for their laws. The second change that Senate Bill 944 makes is that it would prohibit evidence regarding a victim's manner of dress from being entered as evidence of that she consented or incited the sex crime. This prohibition has long been the law in the majority of states. Victims' advocates have always argued that no matter how a woman is dressed, she does not deserve to be raped. I always like to make the analogy that I think helps with this. In a robbery case, we don't allow in evidence about the gold jewelry and the diamonds that the robbery victim has as evidence that she wanted the mugger to rob her. This measure protects not only the integrity of the victim, but also of the court. The final change is the addition of language that reads, lack of verbal or physical resistance does not constitute consent. This provision is important because what we've been hearing from law enforcement and prosecutors is that the investigation stops if there's no signs of resistance. Resistance can be life-threatening. Most other states are capable of investigating and prosecuting sex crimes without requiring the victim to resist, and Oregon can too. We know from FBI statistics that rape is the most underreported crime. We should not allow these barriers that we have in our laws to further inhibit the investigation and then the prosecution of rape in the first degree. The changes in Senate Bill 944 do not affect the safeguards that currently exist in the sex offense statute, which require the prosecutor to prove that force was used against the victim. These changes shift the focus from the victim back on the defendant, where they should be. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and the coalition urges your support on Senate Bill 944. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Wilner. Questions? Comments? Okay, Loretta. Public, please.
Chairman Bryant, members of the committee, I'm Loretta Howard. I'm here to support the Senate Bill 944. I've traveled 3 hours to come here. On August 2nd, 1998, I was lured from Tuesday to Bandon. From Bandon, I was forced to travel to Gold Beach. I was then raped. My rapist had a gun. For approximately 7 hours, I was repeatedly raped. This person threatened my life and my family's life if I didn't do exactly what I was instructed to do. If I made him mad, it was clear to me that he would harm me or my family. I was too scared to physically fight back. Everyone who knows, he is prone to fits of rage. I did pull away as hard as I could. I hit my head on something, and I was trapped. I couldn't back up anymore. I was overpowered. I begged him to please stop, but he wouldn't. I was left with bruises on my arms and legs. I was too afraid and ashamed to tell anyone for several months. And I started receiving threatening phone calls, letters, and cards. I finally broke down and told my husband after a failed attempted suicide. When I did ask for help, I found out that since I didn't punch, scratch, bite, or forcibly fight back, that the Oregon State Police, Tuesday Police, Bannon Police, and Gold Beach Police wouldn't consider my kidnap and rape a crime. The earnest resistance law would change injustices such as what I have been forced to endure. I pleaded and begged for their help. They all said I wasn't raped. All of the agencies that were supposed to be defending and protecting me were stating as a matter of fact that I was not raped. The way that I was treated was as though I was being raped again, only this time rather than a man being the rapist, I was being raped by the system that was supposed to protect the innocent. It was as though the criminal had more fight than does the victim. By removing the earnest resistance law, no more would the victim have to be subjected to physical violence in order to have the police protect them. No more would the victim be ridiculed by the police agencies for bringing charges against the criminal. I've been followed and harassed. Even now, my rapist will go as far as to run a red light to get in front of me so that he can smile and laugh at me. He flaunts a system that he knows how to control, and he knows he got away with it. I've asked repeatedly for protection against being stalked. The police refuse to take the report. The police will believe a rapist over me just because I didn't physically fight back. Simply speaking, my school wasn't bashed in, so there wasn't a crime committed. I failed to resist sufficiently, so the system doesn't have to protect me. He is the criminal, and he hasn't even had his concealed firearm permit revoked. He still carries a loaded gun with him everywhere he goes. I have a life sentence because I did what I had to do in order to survive. Because of the earnest resistance law, I live looking over my shoulder. I always have someone with me everywhere I go, and I can't trust anyone anymore. So much has been stolen away from my husband and myself. Sometimes I feel like it's my fault. I wasn't powerful enough. Sometimes I wish he would have just shot and killed me that night so my husband and I wouldn't have to go through this mental ordeal every day. At least then he would have been prosecuted. Now he still has a chance to do it again and again. Before I was kidnapped and raped, I did have a first-hand experience of what happens after a violent rape. Someone close to me was raped, and she tried to fight back. I went into the emergency room with her. I watched as they took pictures of her scratches and bloody face. Her body was bruised and discolored. There was severe swelling about her face. Her body was turning dark purple and blue. It was terrifying to see what happened to her. She did physically try to fight back. At the time of my rapist knew of my fears of how victims are treated. He also knew that my wrist had cysts and that weakened them. He is a danger to everyone he meets and needs to be stopped. By taking out this earnest resistance law, it will help stop him and everyone who are masters of manipulating the system. Maybe the next victim will have a chance for closure and will know that there is someone out there they can turn to. The victim should have a safe haven. There needs to be someone who cares about her. There needs to be someone on her side. No one should be put on the side of the rapist. It's high time that the rights of the victim is placed before the rights of a rapist. I've had an Oregon State police officer from the Coos Bay office tell me that I wasn't raped. As well, a detective and a Coos Bay police officer has echoed the same sentiment, all because of their ignorance and this earnest resistance law. If this law was revoked, maybe the victims wouldn't have to undergo polygraphs, interrogations, and fingerprinting as I did. I was called into police offices to defend myself just because I asked for help. No one should be afraid to ask for protection, and no one should be made to do anything against his or her will. When your life is threatened, will you do what you have to do to survive? You shouldn't be punished for being scared. Please go home tonight and be thankful for what you have. I pray none of you will ever be subjected to what my husband, family, and I have had to endure. I will go home looking over my shoulder just because I didn't physically fight back after I was raped. I asked for help and didn't receive any. I will regret that for the rest of my life, all because of this earnest resistance law. This is how the earnest resistance law has affected me in my life, and will continue to do so for as long as he allows me to live. This law needs to be changed, otherwise victims like me will continue getting assaulted. This must not be allowed to continue. The authorities must be made to take action in order to protect the victims It's time for a change. The rapist should be punished. Since when did no mean something different than no? I've already been punished. Please don't allow other victims to be punished just for asking for help. Please stop the criminals and stand up for me and stop this travesty. Don't sit idle by and permit this to happen again. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this witness? And next we have Phyllis.
My name is Phyllis Barkers. I'm the Executive Director of Sexual Assault Support Services in Eugene. And what you just witnessed with the previous person who testified is basically what people in my line of work deal with every day and night and weekend. And what we see, advocates for rape victims around the state, we're pretty much a demoralized lot. And we're pretty demoralized because we see very little access to justice. When we work with the few people who do report rapes and want to proceed by seeing their cases prosecuted, it's very difficult. There's a lot of barriers. And some of the barriers are we're talking about today. One of the barriers is the attention on the victim's behavior about what did she do or not do when finding herself in a situation where she was being sexually assaulted. And I sit through police interviews all the time, and questions are asked over and over and in different ways about, usually starting with, did you say no? What else did you do? Did you fight back? Did you physically show that you didn't want this to happen? And really a lot of attention on how much the victim physically fought. Most survivors of rape do not physically fight their attackers because of feeling afraid or terror or frozen on them. It's uncommon for somebody to do that. We do a lot of work in women's self-defense as well, and what we see is most women have never been in a physical conflict in their life as an adult. So to expect women to all of a sudden, in one of the most scary or terrifying situations, to all of a sudden know how to physically defend themselves against somebody who's bigger and stronger in the overwhelming majority of cases is unrealistic. What it does in the aftermath of a sexual assault is place the victim to have to defend herself. So from the time she reports the rape, usually at the hospital or in the immediate aftermath, she has to defend her behavior. When you sit in the courtroom and watch the rape trial progress or take place, there's often and always a lot of attention again on what the victim was doing, what messages she gave off, whether she fought enough, what clothing she wore. There's a lot of barriers, as I said. There's a lot of barriers to having access to justice for rape victims around the state. Really support Senate Bill 944 and feel that it would be sending a message out very clearly, as well as giving prosecutors more options so they don't have to design their case around proving forcible compulsion, earnest resistance to forcible compulsion. They can design their case around what did the rapist do? What was his behavior? What did he do to check out whether this was okay? Was there consent involved? And make sure that the prosecution is based on what other crimes are based on. This person is accused, and it needs to be proven that they committed this crime, and the bill doesn't take away that fact. So we have a lot of hope around the state. I was in Florence 2 weeks ago doing training for advocates at Acuse Bay in Florence. I was in Bend a month ago doing 2 days of training there. I go all over the state training advocates, and we spend a lot of time debriefing our experiences of, I had this case, and this case, and this case, and this case, and what happened with those cases, and most of the time as well, nothing really. So you have rape victims and also their advocates who really want to see a change. And this is a change for the better, and we really support it as people on the line. We're the ones 24 hours a day in the hospital, and we ask you to support this. It really will, with a little bit of effort, make a big change all across the state. Thank you.
Question for this one. Dale, have you testified? I had to step out for a moment, so I was switching chairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. I'm representing the District Attorney's Association on this bill. We support the bill, and we would ask the committee to pass this bill. If you have seen the handout that the coalition has prepared, just with different statistics involving sexual assaults. It documents an issue that we know to be true and that we've discussed in society and in the media for years and years, and that is that sexual assault is highly underreported. And these statistics show us that. We have all seen cases in the media where a victim has been chastised or a person turned loose because of the clothing the victim wears, the attacks that have been made on victims throughout the United States at different times. And unfortunately, that whole environment and those types of stories are things that we've heard about for years and years. And so it is not surprising that sexual assault is very much underreported. You've heard about barriers that come forward, and these are barriers to reporting, to investigating, to prosecuting this crime. I want to make one point very clear. This bill does not change the requirement that the state must prove the elements of the crime. This bill does not change the requirement that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that forcible compulsion was used in a crime. It simply, in the first part of this, removes this requirement of earnest resistance, which when we look at any other crime and when we look at what we advise victims to do or survivors to do, we will tell them in bank robberies and armed robberies and all other types of crimes, burglaries, don't ever resist the offender. Comply with the demands so that you can live for another day. And yet here is the only crime in the criminal code where we're telling a victim, you must resist. It's not wise. It's not appropriate. And as we understand, other states have clearly wiped this from the statutes, including Michigan, from which this statute was adopted originally by the state of Oregon. So it is now time for the state of Oregon to remove that barrier, keeping in mind that the state still must prove that there was forcible compulsion involved for it to be a crime. It simply means a victim is not required to resist that forcible compulsion. The other two elements of this bill involve that clothing should not be an issue, that a victim should not be attacked or should not be brought up before the court that in some way a particular type of clothing invited sexual assault. Now, there's a process in the bill that for some reason, if it's constitutionally mandated, if it is appropriate under the unique facts of the case, a judge is still going to have a hearing about this and still going to analyze that, and there could be some fact where perhaps, let's say, a victim would say that, or let's say a defendant would say that this particular victim, I knew this victim, and this victim told me that when she wore this precise set of clothing in some way, that was some signal that we had developed between us. That's about the only factual scenario where I would see, well, perhaps constitutionally that might be appropriate or that could come in. But the general case should be the principle that someone's clothes do not invite sexual assault. I think the example that Ms. McClard gave about a robbery victim, a burglary victim, is appropriate here. Someone who wears expensive jewelry, never do we say that that is an invitation to robbery. It should be the same rule in sexual assault.
Would a defense counsel be allowed to ask, what were you wearing?
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe that if clothing in some way was going to be an issue in the case, that this process would say there needs to be a pretrial hearing about that and it should be discussed. I do believe the simple question about what someone is wearing, I guess better practice with this would be let's bring that out, let's talk about it, let's ask why is that bringing forward, but
That simple question, without argument, without any other discussion, probably would be allowed. But if you get into arguing what someone is wearing after you've asked that question, or follow-up questions, I would say that you must follow this process in having a pretrial ruling.
Yes, around.
This issue regarding clothing has been introduced for several sessions. I remember the first session was 95, and my recollection is the DA's office did not, your association did not like the language in the House bill at that time. And my recollection was the issue was, for example, if it was an old lady, they wanted to be able to say, you know, the state wanted to be able to show that she was dressed in old lady clothing or whatever. That's all I can think of in terms of examples. Are you feeling comfortable with this language in terms of your abilities to prosecute?
Ms. Chair and Senator Brown, I do recall there have been prior bills. I don't believe that we have ever opposed them. There may be individual prosecutors who have brought forward different scenarios. This is a bill that we have discussed in association and support, and we would do so today. I can't speak for perhaps some reticence in the past, but we certainly support it now. And I don't believe that kind of thing would be a problem. I would see that it may be that we need to have a pretrial ruling about whether or not it's appropriate to go into that. But I think that's appropriate under the statute being proposed.
Thank you.
My concern on that would be I don't have a problem with not being able to argue that the type of clothing incited someone to act a certain way, but that's the circumstances of the situation. You described the room, the conversation, you know, who was there, the people, what they were wearing. That, to me, would be legitimate inquiry.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's why I believe that my analysis of this, and that's only my analysis, that is a very innocuous statement. However, if it is used to open the door to other things, that's what this statute is intended to get at. Clearly, you're going to have to paint a picture for the jury of the circumstances, and that would come forward. Many times there may be physical evidence on the clothing that would come in, and there is a specific reference to that in the this Senate Bill 944. But I would agree. However, what I've seen is that it isn't just that question. It is taken much farther than that, and argument is accompanied to it. And I think that's why you need to have statutory direction for a trial court to have something to grab hold of to say, no, argument is not appropriate on that point. I simply go forward and finish with the last issue that is brought forward in the bill is that failure to say no does not mean yes. That's my interpretation of that last part of the bill. And again, I want to bring forward that it is still incumbent upon the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt either that force was used or, if it is a non-consensual crime, that there was no consent. However, this would prohibit the attack against the victim, and as you heard, perhaps the difficulty in investigations and in prosecutions, that the practical effect now is that if there is not a statement of no, that it can be a very difficult case to go forward. And this is just a legislative statement of purpose, that failure to say no does not mean yes. That does not change the fact that the state must prove it was non-consensual, and we must prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. But it removes, again, that victim attack and victim blaming and type of argument that goes forward against a victim by saying that simply because you did not say no, that does not mean that you were innocent. Now, the state still must prove the crime, but it is not an attack on the victim. I believe that other states have clearly moved beyond Oregon in both of these three areas, and we believe it is now time for the state of Oregon to join the vast majority of the other states in saying that these three areas, these three barriers, should be removed from sexual assault reporting, sexual assault investigations, and sexual assault prosecutions.
Thank you. Question? Yes, Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Are you saying that if someone is raped at gunpoint and they don't resist, that they can't be prosecuted?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, if the allegation is force, Oregon law requires earnest resistance to force. Now, there are circumstances that you could argue that certainly in that scenario, being threatened with a weapon, that is a threat. And so you go forward in the statute, and those are two separate clauses. You have forcible compulsion, which requires resistance, but then you have a threat express or implied, which under those circumstances you did not have to have resistance. But so you could have situations where that would come forward. Now, that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be some argument, and that's why we believe the statute needs to be cleared up. Take that earnest resistance component totally out of the statute. It shouldn't be there at all, whether it's force or implied or expressed threat. Technically, threatened by a gun, it shouldn't be an issue. Practically, with the statute the way it is, it comes into many cases. And that's why we believe it needs to be removed.
Thank you.
Mr. Penn, I looked at the annotations and I did a word search of Federal Overton's earnest resistance, and I could not find any Supreme Court cases or appellate court cases defining it. What does it mean? What will it mean when it's taken out?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, it is always a jury issue, and we believe it removes. I mean, obviously there is a requirement of resistance there, and we believe that is the component that should be removed. And the confusing thing, and something that we tell all other victims, and we train victims through public education, do not resist. So why should there be that comment here? We believe it confuses and it puts a requirement on sexual assault victims that should not be there. The focus should be on, was there forcible compulsion? Was there physical force that was involved? Not, did the victim resist, whether it was earnest or not.
Other questions? Thank you for the testimony. Our final three witnesses are Claudia Weber, Ingrid Clinton, and Arnie Green. And Ingrid, I'll have you go last.
All right. Mr. Chair, just a comment. I know some Senator Keith had introduced a bill this morning that I believe Gina McClard and other folks testified on it, and I don't remember the bill number, but it dealt with the unitary assessment fee and using those funds to fund sexual assault services. And I'm thinking, as I heard the witness testify, that from Coos Bay area, that maybe we need to, it's unfortunate that Ms. Middle was not here to hear the testimony and focus on the training issues that it raises in terms of law enforcement and dealing with these issues, since she was there this morning to testify against their bill.
Okay. My name is Claudia Weber. I am a rape victim advocate for Washington County. I'm also the volunteer coordinator for the Rape Crisis Center. It says on your fact sheet that there are two standalone sexual assault agencies. Well, we are one of them. And Senator Brown, your comment about the unitary assessment fee, we are a nonprofit organization. We've been in existence for 22 years. And even though our name says Rape Crisis Center, we have never had a center. We have never had a building. We work out of our director's home. All our volunteers work out of their homes, and we are notified by pager on an answering service, which is our 24-hour crisis line. But I'm here really to talk about this bill and the difficulties that we see with rape survivors. I am also a survivor of a sexual assault.
I was raped when I was in my early 20s, which was a long time ago. But the myths that prevailed then prevail today. In my particular situation, it was a family friend, a man who was old enough to be my father, who came to my home on, quote, business. I was a single mother at that time, and I had an 18-month-old child asleep in another room. After I had repeatedly told him that this wasn't right and I didn't want him to do this, he continued, and no, I did not resist because I didn't want my son to wake up and walk in to see what was happening. Earnest resistance must be removed so more people can protect themselves and their families. I work with survivors of sexual assault on a daily basis. I am a 60-hour-a-week volunteer for the Rape Crisis Center, and I've been doing this for about 18 months now. I train law enforcement in Washington County to the sensitivity issues of sexual assault. I do school talks. I do public speaking in many areas in the county and outside of the county. And the questions that are always raised to me are, if I don't fight, what's going to happen? The analogy was used before about a robbery. I think another analogy can be with a bank robbery. Bank tellers have been trained for years now that if someone comes in and uses a gun and says, give me all your money, they don't resist. They give them all their money. That doesn't mean that they are agreeing to a robbery. They are protecting themselves. Law enforcement has a very difficult time, and in all the interviews that I sit in on, both at the hospital and the emergency room, after a sexual assault exam, which is the most humiliating, horrible experience that anybody can go through, men or women, to sitting in on interviews with deputy DAs before court, and even going to court, we do court accompaniment as well. The question is always, did you say no? Why didn't you fight? The traumatization that perpetrates on a victim does not allow them to become a survivor. And we like to call all of our clients survivors because they are able to get up and walk away. They may be injured, but the physical injuries will heal. The only victim out there is the one that no longer has a voice. And we deal with survivors. And we need to give survivors back their dignity and their control and their power of their own lives, which was taken away with the perpetrator. We know that rapists rape between 6 and 8 times before they're ever caught, and more than that before they're prosecuted. This would help to totally reduce those statistics. The survivors need to be able to heal. More than 50% of all survivors, actually I believe it's more than 75% of all survivors, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's believed that more survivors of sexual assault than war veterans suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. There's no healing allowed when they've been told because they did not resist or because of the clothing they were wearing, and that they didn't say no, that they only said, I don't want to do this, please stop, that they were not raped. I even had a doctor in an emergency room take me aside after the sexual assault evidence exam and say, do you think this really happened? And I said, yes. And this doctor said, but she never said no. And I quickly educated the doctor to let her know that this survivor had said many times, I don't want to do this, stop, this isn't right,
please don't. But because she did not use the word N-O, she was not considered a rape victim by an emergency room doctor. I beg you to please consider the removal of this totally derogatory language that only further victimizes survivors of sexual assault. Thank you.
In your situation, did you report the crime and did law enforcement pursue it?
No. I never reported the crime. I knew that nothing would happen. I'm well into my 50s now, and it was only about 15 years ago that I even had the courage to tell my husband. And that's the first that I dealt with it. My father, who died 3 years ago, never knew. My mother is still alive, is 80 years old, and she will never know. And that's because the myths that surround sexual assault have to be destroyed.
Bernie.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Arnie Green. I'm from Jackson County. I'm the director of an agency down there called Community Works. We run the domestic violence shelter and the rape crisis program. I'm glad Senator Brown mentioned the bill this morning because we are also in favor of that. Our rape crisis program consists of 1 3-quarter time professional who herds a group of volunteers around Patriots 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it's in need of a lot more resources. I just come in support of the bill, and I can't speak anywhere near as eloquently as the folks before me who have survived it and who deal with it day to day and in the courts, but I promised the people I work for that I would come and testify, and they told me a story that really is echoed by the couple that you've heard already this afternoon. About a year ago in Medford, a single mom was raped and sought help from our rape crisis advocate, and the assault took place in her own home. The perpetrator broke into the home, broke into her bedroom, and her 2 young children, about 3 and 5, were asleep in bedrooms down the hall. And she was absolutely petrified that if she even made any noise, let alone resist, that her children might wake up, come in the room, and be harmed by this individual. So she said nothing and did nothing. So I think that's the case that simply, this guy hasn't been caught yet, but had he been caught, I can imagine that he would put up some kind of defense saying that she never resisted. This is old language, way beyond anything that we can have in this day and age. So please vote yes on this. This is a good one. Thank you.
Ingrid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. In some ways, I'm rather appalled by what I've heard this afternoon because I think police agencies and district attorneys must not be reading this law. Senator Burdick asked a direct question. If you're raped at gunpoint, do you have to resist? Absolutely not. And the law says that. It says it directly. It defines forcible compulsion as either physical force that overcomes resistance or a threat expressed or implied that places a person in fear of future death or physical injury to the person or another person, or that the person will be kidnapped in the future. Who could ever say that a gun to your head didn't amount to an express threat, let alone an implied threat? And in listening to the details of Ms. Harwood's case, her life was threatened, her family's life was threatened. What prosecutor, what police officer could ignore the black and white law that's in front of you that says that's enough, that's all you need, you don't need anything more? This language serves a purpose, and I ask the committee not to remove the earnest resistance language. In cases before, and if you looked for a lot of cases explaining this language, it's correct. There aren't many. The only Court of Appeals cases and Supreme Court cases that deal with it, there are 3 or 4 of them. But what becomes apparent is that if you're talking about stranger-to-stranger conduct, the court is very quick to find an implied threat. You needn't do anything. If somebody breaks in your house and forcibly rapes you, it's implied that that threat, just by forcible entry of your house, is sufficient. I cited a case in the material I gave you, State versus Odoms, where a woman asks for help from a man. She accepts a ride from him, and he's supposedly going to help her. After she goes with him, he decides that he would like her to become a prostitute, and he talks to her about doing that and tries to persuade her to do this. She doesn't like this, and she's asked, "Why didn't you just leave?" And she said, "Well, I was afraid to." And then she ends up engaging in sex with him multiple times. He is prosecuted and convicted of kidnapping and forcible rape without any evidence of overt threats of any kind or any kind of injury to this victim, and that was upheld by the Court of Appeals. That's all that was needed, the fact that under those circumstances she was fearful of him and she did not want to do the acts that occurred between them. When we're talking about relationships between people who know each other or between sexual partners, that's when you run into difficulty. And that's when things that people say and mean become ambiguous. Our law serves a purpose in those situations because it said, you know, it's not enough to simply say, "Well, I really didn't want to do it." You've got to express that in some manner if you're talking about a sexual relationship between adults who know each other, who are able to talk to each other, who are able to converse and convey information back and forth. You can't expect that to be understood. It's not unfair to ask that lack of desire to engage in that behavior be expressed in some fashion. And if during the course of sexual contact between adults, I mean, sex is a forcible act in some ways, and to simply delete this earnest resistance, you're left with use of force. Well, it takes some kind of force to engage in sexual intercourse. So we're talking about an element of force which is always present. And the question is, does the other party also join in the desire to engage in this act or not? And requiring physical resistance is not inappropriate in those kinds of relationships. I would like to talk about the other parts of the bill with respect to the language on page 2 of the bill. A lack of verbal or physical resistance does not constitute consent. We've been talking about the need for physical resistance, but at least some effort to convey that this is not acceptable needs to happen. With regard to the clothing, Senator Brown is certainly correct. We've seen this language before, and the difficulty that we have two difficulties with it. One is, I think what it's trying to get at is those cases where defendants claim they were incited by what someone wore. And I think the committee could well say, well, that shouldn't be appropriate. That shouldn't be accepted. That shouldn't be part of the evidence. If people allow themselves to be incited by clothing, we're not going to allow that to be used in their defense. But when you're talking about consent, that's another matter. And it's another matter because people convey consent in different ways. And Mr. Penn talked about a circumstance where indeed a person might intend their clothing to say, "I consent to or I invite this particular conduct on this particular occasion." That may be the case. The bill as written would not allow that evidence to come in, period. It doesn't come in because there are two provisions. The first one says that the use of evidence of the clothing of the victim to show consent is not admissible, period. If that's your purpose, it doesn't come in. If you want to show clothing for some other purpose than consent, then you can go through this process which is described in subsection 3 of the bill. But not if you want to show consent. That doesn't work for you. It's specifically excluded from that list. Mr. Penn also talked about cases where
items of clothing constitute physical evidence, either because they contain bodily fluids or because they are either torn or not torn, and the evidence in the case involves clothing that is either torn or not torn. This subsection 3 would allow it in as rebuttal evidence. The defense could use it as rebuttal evidence, but it is not allowed to come in as direct evidence admitted by the defense to say whether or not it's in rebuttal to testimony from the state. Also, there's no provision for allowing clothing to come in as physical evidence, just as plain physical evidence, and it would appear to be excluded, or at least it could be construed to be excluded by the language here. In fact, in the written materials I provided, I indicated that a court might well find that if the legislature excluded evidence of clothing, that the legislators intent was so clear and so specific that even this constitutional reservation would not be sufficient, and the court could well dismiss the case and say, under the circumstances of this case, since the defense is not allowed to present an element of defense which is absolutely critical to due process, but the legislature has made it very clear that under no circumstances may that evidence come in, I have no choice but to dismiss this case. So those are the concerns we have, Mr. Chief.
In looking at the first page, and I don't have a problem in deleting that overcomes earnest resistance, but then it reads, means physical force or a threat, da-da-da, and sexual contact involves physical force. So wouldn't you need to say unwelcome physical force? I choose the word unwelcome because that's the phrase we use with sexual harassment and those types of words. Because if it's welcome physical force, then it wouldn't be a rape. And maybe, Arnie, you could give your seat up to Dale here because we're arguing on it. Unless you want to become an attorney. But wouldn't that be an appropriate adjective to put in there? Because it should be, it would read then means unwelcome physical force or a threat expressed or implied.
Mr. Chair, if you're asking me that question, Dale Penn, again, Marion County District Attorney. I guess that's something to consider. I guess, my own thoughts about it, however, is that other states have had this precise issue before them that has not been an issue that has come up, and this is language which Michigan removed for the reasons we've discussed. My own thought is that we need to prove that physical force is involved in the act of sex for it to be a crime, and the whole dynamics there is going to require that this is unwelcome for it to proceed at all. But having
to ponder that,
sure,
we won't work going to work session today. The other thing that, and I've read it 10 times, and it might be because I'm tired, and we're going to go back into floor session at 6:30, but subparagraph 3 on page 2. I understand what you're trying to do. That is worded, I think, very awkwardly. And as I said in my question to you, I don't want to preclude any questions that would set the basic scene as to what has been required. I think you get into that constitutional problem if you try to prohibit that. And so I didn't want to be a wordsmith there, but at least I find it a little awkward.
Yeah, makes sense.
And so to my other members here. So
one other comment, if I may, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the definition of rape in the first degree, and it's defined simply as a person who has sexual intercourse with another person where the victim is subjected to forcible compulsion. So indeed, if you define forcible compulsion as the use of physical force, every act of intercourse becomes rape in the first degree unless it's refined in some fashion.
Mr. Chair, I guess that's an issue to discuss, as you mentioned, whether unwelcome is the right word, or the problem is that you don't want to replace earnest resistance with some other term which then places the burden on the victim to in some way resist what is occurring. Physical force. I think I understand the argument that physics involved, that there is some push and pull involved. That doesn't mean that the context of criminal physical force is invoked.
Would you have that burden to show that it was unwelcome in order to prove the case?
Mr. Chair, in practical terms, certainly. We are talking about prosecuting somebody for a crime of rape, and in practical terms, that's what we're going to have to convince a jury, is that this is a crime, number one, and that this physical force is such that it justifies a conviction for rape in the first degree. The other comment that I'd make about that subsection 3 that we just discussed is I disagree with Ms. Swenson's analysis is otherwise constitutionally required to be admitted, that that last little clause. I believe that clearly what that says to any court is that when there is impeachment value, when there is anything that the defendant could argue, this is necessary for my defense, or that this is my defense here. Clearly, exculpatory evidence or any time a defendant's right to present their defense is infringed by statute, that's exactly what this is intended to allow. A court is very much aware a defendant does have to have the capability to present exculpatory evidence and their defense. And so I believe that that is the reason for that subsection, and would clearly give notice to the trial court this does allow the defendant to put it in. But
I want to be a little more proactive in approaching it because I don't want the trial court to be faced immediately with a hearing to determine whether or not he has to allow or she has to allow testimony about what the general setting was at the time. So give that some thought too. We'll bring the bill back and we'll try and send it around.
I'm sorry, I had to run errand, and this may have been addressed already, but I guess my question is for Ingrid, and it's regarding the earnest resistance issue. And for me, what today's lesson was about was lack of education on part of law enforcement and prosecution. And I guess my question would be, even just by the very fact that that's in the statute, isn't it going to sort of block our ability to educate folks? I mean, when you read the statute, people see earnest resistance. And so a not careful reading would think that you would need that in order to prosecute. And so I guess if nothing else, wouldn't getting rid of it help us on the educational aspects?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the statute could certainly be reworded so it's not in the disjunctive. So, and maybe you don't want to even say forcible compulsion is a threat. Maybe you want to say there is either forcible compulsion, which includes resistance, or there is a threat, and not define forcible compulsion as one or the other of those things. That might clarify and make it easier for law enforcement.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, I simply echo that one of the reasons for this bill coming forward is not necessarily so much the investigation and the prosecution, but the huge underreporting and just all of the issues and barriers that victims and survivors feel that I don't even want to report this because of the dynamics, and that's why I believe that phrase is very confusing and counterproductive.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. Other questions? We'll close the public hearing. They weren't here, so I'll see you all in an hour.
Very. I'll see
you with the
tuna fish. I did the tuna fish. And I'm going to fight you for it.